How serious are the superpowers in tackling the planet's climate emergency? In his speech Tuesday to the United Nations General Assembly, Xi Jinping, following the lead of Japan and South Korea and pledging an end to China's financing of coal plants overseas, the United States putting aside escalating tensions to hail that promise. Critics dismiss the announcement as a low-hanging fruit coming from a nation that's home by far to the most domestic coal-fired power plants. We'll ask about the Chinese leader's promise and that of his U.S. counterpart to pledge more aid for energy transition in developing countries. This ahead of next month's crucial COP26 UN climate summit that's taking place in Glasgow, Scotland. Joe Biden, who made no mention of coal in his own speech, will ask about the domestic politics that factor into the Democrats' energy transition policies. And speaking of energy transition, the other big concern as world leaders meet in New York for UN Week is a post-pandemic skyrocketing in natural gas prices. Natural gas billed as the wonder solution for a seamless switch from fossil fuels to the renewables of tomorrow. In Europe, and particularly the UK, it's an immediate concern with fears of shortages this coming winter. And it's a strategic concern, what with major supplier Russia about to get perhaps a lot more leverage when the Nord Stream 2 pipeline to Germany comes online. Can superpowers put aside spiraling rivalries for the common good of the planet? Today in the France 24 debate, we're looking at a brewing cold war and a planet that is overheating. And joining us, Eric Chenet, economic advisor with the Institut Montaigne think tank. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Welcome as well to Anna Créty, director of the Climate Economics Chair at Paris Dauphine University. Thanks for joining us. From Washington, Rina Kui, co-director of the China Program at the University of Maryland's Center for Global Sustainability. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
From Helsinki, Lori Mili Virta, lead analyst at the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening.
The France 24 debate, where you can join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, hashtag F24debate. A great contribution is how John Kerry hails China's announcement. The former U.S. Secretary of State is now Joe Biden's climate envoy. He was reacting, and let's listen to them now, the words of Xi Jinping Tuesday. It's that speech before the United Nations General Assembly.
China will strive to peak carbon dioxide emissions before 2030 and achieve carbon neutrality before 2060. This requires tremendous hard work, and we will make every effort to meet these goals. China will step up support for other developing countries in developing green and low-carbon energy, and will not build new coal-fired power projects abroad.
How big a deal is this, Anna Créty?
Well, on one side, we can say that there is a downturn also in the way in which China is going to affirm his objective of decarbonizing. So the policy is both abroad and also the internal one, the Chinese one. So I think that this announcement is interesting because it is the first time that they recognize their role of their investment in coal abroad, especially in developing countries. Nevertheless, we have to say that they have already started the movement.
And let me ask you about that, because China has that ambitious infrastructure program, Belt and Road Initiative.
Yes.
So when they say they're not going to invest abroad, does that mean Chinese private companies won't invest abroad or the Chinese state won't invest abroad?
There are at least two companies, which are state-owned companies, partly state-owned company, that are quite exposed to the dismissal of coal. So it's a mixture between the national interest and also the private one on the investors that have already made a lot of infrastructure, in particular in Korea, in Africa, a lot of them. So I think that the two, both China and private investors, are involved.
All right. So a possible turning point, Eric Chenet?
Well, I think the turning point has already been passed. And this is a kind of cosmetic announcement, which is about exports. And you remember, Xi Jinping said abroad. Yes. He did not say inland. And China is producing 50% of the coal produced in the world.
Yeah, we can show up a graph that shows active coal plants around the world, and you can see right. when we look at that graph that China dwarfs all comers.
Yes, but the point is China has already started to reduce its sensitivity to coal. If you look at the ratio between GDP and coal production or consumption, which is almost the same in China, it has fallen dramatically over the last 10 years. Even so, China is still building new coal plants. So this is, I would say, a very small step in a direction that was taken already 10 years ago. And China will have to accelerate very seriously its plan to remove coal from electricity generation in the next few years if they want us to take them seriously.
Rina Kui, why is China still building coal plants at home?
Yeah, I think there are several different concerns. Definitely energy security is one of the most important one, I think. How to provide a stable kind of a electricity supply to the increasing demand of the country. That's one of the most important one, I think, in the near term. And
there's
also,
no alternative? There's no alternative to coal plants?
Well, there are concerns. I think we all know, like, China also grew tremendously in terms of the renewable solar wind in the past 5 years to decade. That's also kind of a really rapid growth in that area. But the concern about renewable is the intermittency, kind of how stable it can provide for the grid. That's both like a technology question, but also kind of how to manage a more modernized grid. So in the near term, I feel like they still have the concern.
And when any politician talks about carbon neutrality in 2060, so what, that's 39 years from now, that's pretty easy, right? Because he won't be around.
Well, I think you were thinking about the peaking time that China announced by 2030 and to the net zero point, which is 30 years. That's 30 years of time from peaking to net zero. That's much shorter than any other country in the world gonna achieve it. So I think even though it seems like it's a long-term in the future, of course, kind of action needs to be taken right now. Peaking early or keeping peaking at a lower level going to help China to achieve the net zero.
Lori Milivirta, you agree that this is an important step?
Definitely. There are several countries in Asia that have been major sources of growth for coal-fired power generation, Vietnam, Indonesia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, that have heavily relied on international financing and Chinese financing to pursue new projects. And for these countries, this really means that international financing is off the table after South Korea and Japan have also announced similar moves. We've identified still about 50 gigawatts of coal-fired capacity, about equal to the entire capacity of Germany, that is being proposed with Chinese backing around the world. So this is the pipeline that will be immediately affected by this announcement.
And let me ask you again how you calculate this kind of stuff. It's important for our viewers, this question, because sitting here in this is my climate-controlled studio in Paris, it's easy to point the finger at China, but they make a lot of stuff for the French market or the Finnish market or the U.S. market. And so those coal-powered plants, are they solely China's fault or is it the whole world's fault?
Right. I think it's important to talk about two different issues here. So so China is domestically the world's largest emitter of CO2. There was a point in time where exports were an important driver of those emissions. But in the past decade, basically after the global financial crisis, exports haven't been the driver of those emissions anymore. It's really been a domestic construction boom that was started in response to the global financial crisis and never stopped, that has just seen China consume absolutely unprecedented amounts of steel and cement and other metals and so on for construction. And the question about peaking China's domestic emissions is about when does that completely excessive construction boom come to an end. Then there's another question, which is that Chinese banks and Chinese firms have been active in building coal-fired power plants overseas with public financing from China. Those are state-owned entities that often enjoy subsidies, so it's really support from the Chinese state to making coal more attractive and more economic. And that has really been pushing other countries in the direction of coal. And having that off the table has the potential to sway the energy policies of those countries that have been relying on Chinese support to expand coal-fired power.
Yeah, a lot of Chinese exports, again, is built on building stuff. Shani, is that all about to change? What we're all watching, what's going on with that troubled real estate conglomerate Evergrande?
Yeah, I think this is a very important event which is unfolding in China. That could be the end of the construction bubble. Of course, the government will have to step in to avoid a financial catastrophe, and no doubt the government will step in. But the very fact that Evergrande is now selling its assets, in my view, that means that probably we have seen the peak in the housing bubble. I wouldn't say the construction bubble, because for infrastructures, China is still going to continue to build a lot of infrastructures. But for the construction bubble, it's probably the peak. And that's a good omen, including for emissions of CO2, which are linked to cement, which are, of course, linked to electricity. But I just wanted to make a point about what you said. We are importing products from China, so we are using Chinese coal. That is true. But if you look at the numbers, the carbon footprint of China is lower than its territorial emissions. I can give you the numbers. It's about 7.1 tons of CO2 per inhabitant in terms of production. And it is only 6.3, only, ton of CO2 per habitant as far as the carbon footprint is concerned. So you remove the exports toward, but France is at 6.6. So a small country like France and a big country like China, they have almost the same footprint per inhabitant. So in terms of what we have to do to go to carbon neutrality, we are starting from the same point. With the big difference is that China is a much poorer country than France or the US are. So right. In terms of the efforts to be made, I would say that a lot has to be made by the US, but also by Europe.
Also by Europe. And just before we go to the break, news headlines have been dominated here by Australia scuttling a submarine deal with France, instead opting for US technology. It's created a diplomatic row. Australia, which has been a major exporter of coal to China. And before COVID, China was Australia's second biggest buyer of coal behind Japan. Now other countries like India appear to be making up the shortfall of that unofficial boycott that started last year after Scott Morrison, the prime minister, asked whether coronavirus originated in China. Nonetheless, this idea of who's selling coal to whom is also something important to put in the equation, Anna Créty.
Yes, because, I mean, these are international markets. So the equilibrium is made by, of course, China, who is a source of very high demand, and then the suppliers to China, given their proximity or not, they have to somehow respond to this very high demand. Now the role of Australia is specific because they rely a lot of on exports, and they don't have a clear a policy for the energy transition, at least at the state level. So the Ministry of Energy cites the fact that they have to exit coal. Also, their the overall chain is very inefficient.
Very inefficient in Australia. And when the Chinese stop buying their coal and the Indians say, we'll have it, thank you, does that tell you, if you're an environmentalist, that crime pays?
Well, this is the point of not being serious in something like a global agreement, in which there is not only the state, but also the global equilibrium that is taken into account. So we cannot just displace coal and say what we take out from Australia goes to India instead of going to China, if we don't calculate, it's not the national footprint, but it's the global footprint. If we don't have something that signals, that calls us to remain underground, this is the best place where it can be, well, we can have these trade wars.
No mention of coal in Joe Biden's speech Tuesday at the UN. We'll hear more from him when we come back. Stay with us. You're watching the France 24 debate. Welcome back, or welcome if you're just joining us. It's the France 24 debate, and we've been talking the last 2 weeks about spiraling superpower rivalries between the U.S. and China, with Washington asking the West to pick sides. At the same time, those superpowers are going to have to come together to deal with the climate emergency. With us to talk about it, Éric Chanet, economic advisor with the Institut Montaigne think tank, Anna Créty, director of the Climate Economics Chair at Paris-Dauphine University here in the French capital. From Washington, Rina Kui, co-director of the China Program at the University of Maryland's Center for Global Sustainability. And from Helsinki, Lauri Milivirta, lead analyst at the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. Now, UN Week in New York is also a prelude to the crucial issue at next month's COP26 climate summit that'll be taking place in Glasgow. The crucial issue there will be funding for developing nations so they can finance their own energy transition. That's where Joe Biden put the accent Tuesday in his speech in New York.
I announced the United States will double our public international financing to help developing nations tackle the climate crisis. And today, I'm proud to announce that we'll work with the Congress to double that number again, including for adaptation efforts.
Rina Kui, is that a big announcement?
Yes, I think that's really important that the U.S. is committed to the climate finance question, because that's always kind of a one piece missing puzzle, like in any of the like international negotiation. So I think that's moving towards a right direction, and the U.S. stepping up, and as you said, the superpower, the powerful countries are going towards that direction. I think that's really important.
And we mentioned it at the outset, Rhi, Biden's climate envoy, John Kerry, hailing the speech by Xi Jinping. Can we live with, you know, these sort of alternative universes where, on the one hand, they're rivals, perhaps even foes when it comes to the South Pacific, and yet they're partners when it comes to climate change?
Yeah, it is really tough. I think the historically, like, U.S.-China climate partnership really had a great effect, especially pre-Paris negotiation. I think we all remember there's a big joint announcement between China and the Obama administration that really kind of provide a really good a catalytic effect to lead to a successful Paris Agreement. I think that's all examples that can demonstrate the importance of the joint leadership from both countries. But I think currently it's really tough because the topics wise, although climate change remains seems like only really promising area for good collaboration, but it's getting hard when everything else kind of went to the opposite direction. But I think it's really important that U.S.-China can work together on the climate issue.
All right. And if Biden made no mention of coal in his speech, it's no oversight. He's got a one-seat majority in the U.S. Senate and needs every vote he can get to pass his infrastructure and energy transition bill. So meet Joe Manchin. This is the centrist Democrat from West Virginia, who you could say holds outsized power as the chair of the Senate's Energy and Natural Resources Committee. This week, the New York Times revealed that Manchin earned $500 million last year from personal ties to the coal industry. Ties that predate his political career. The Times reporting that when Biden's climate infrastructure bill reaches his desk, Mr. Manchin's version is widely expected to have less ambitious renewable energy requirements for electric power companies. His version could also reward utilities that build new power plants designed to burn natural gas. Rena, when you decided to become a teacher, did you know you'd have to also be studying constitutional, the constitutional workings of the U.S. government, how this one senator holds all of this power over this issue?
Yeah, it's like fascinating, like how kind of the research make real impact in the policy world is always complicated. But I think one thing I also want to mention, like in the U.S., the political system, the federal government, kind of the power is important in the climate or energy transition, but it's not the only path, right? That we kind of in the past 4 years, like a climate action in the U.S. actually happened at all levels, so including state, cities, and businesses. So I think that's a very good signal and also demonstrated in order to increase climate action, it needs to be happening at all level, at all society. That's the only way we can achieve ambitious climate goal. And it's the same outside U.S. as well. But I feel like the federal government kind of comes in now with the new administration, it's adding more promise to the right to the bright side. But still, I think the kind of the all society approach is important. But I hear you. The one state is because of the stakeholder interest in that particular kind of a direction gonna be tough. But I think there's hope in that as well.
Lori Mili Virta, when you're sitting in Helsinki, how reliable does the United States seem as a partner when we've seen all the ups and downs on this issue? Donald Trump walking away from the Paris Climate Agreement again, this grand announcement by Joe Biden just a few months ago that the post-pandemic spending bill would be largely devoted to energy transition, and now we're seeing it get watered down. How reliable is the United States?
I think what Rainer just pointed out is key. We may be focused too much at what's happening in Washington, D.C. It's important to look at what's happened in the rest of the country. The United States has been retiring coal plants faster than Europe, and in fact, at a rate that is consistent with a 2030 coal phase out. So on the power sector, the United States has been at the forefront, and in fact, famously, more coal-fired power plants retired under Trump's presidential term than Obama's second term, which is not the impression that you would get from looking at DC politics. The challenge in the US is all the other sectors besides the power sector. The emission reductions have been coming from the power sector, but now you really need to get a handle on transport and industry and the residential sector. And I think in terms of electrification, electric cars, and so on, a lot of private innovation and state-level measures are being taken that will improve things, but there's certainly a long way to go.
Anna Kati, you heard before the break Eric Chanet saying Europe needs to raise its game too when it comes to these issues. When you look at some of the main issue that Joe Biden addressed on Tuesday, which is climate financing for developing nations, is the EU doing enough?
Well, I think that the reference was made to one of the specific question addressed by the Paris Agreement. Beside all the other measures, it has been established to create a fund that has been financed by all the, let's say, rich countries in order to help the other part of the world that needs to be decarbonized, but at the same time still continue to grow, which was one of their, primary question in entering the climate agreement. So the burden of financing and contributing to this fund has been already decided, and after the decision for the United States to step down, the question was how we can fill the remaining part. So everything that it is included in the diplomatic agreement behind the Paris Agreement that has been already enacted. The question is then how in practice we move in countries that are very heterogeneous, that are relying on the energy systems that are very different. They have also a scope of decarbonization which is different. And this has to be made.
Yeah, because a lot of these countries, I look at West Africa and countries where there's big growth like Ivory Coast, they say we need energy plants. We don't care what kind of energy plants. We need electricity.
Yeah, this is, we need to rebuild perhaps something that we wanted to avoid, which is planning. So in Africa, of course, renewables are a very important source of at least electricity, because there we have also a problem of electrifying the population that has on average only 20% access to energy. So the challenge is to give at the same time growth, access to energy, but decarbonized energy. Even though those countries have perhaps fossil fuels that they can use, typically coal, gas, and oil. But we want to avoid to take the worst track, that it is what we have done in the past. So Europe is part of this equation. But I think that Europe is quite ambitious. The problem is that in the global CO2 accounting, the weight of Europe is not that big. So we can go farther. We have a lot of instruments. We have a lot of...
Why? Because we only represent 6% of the world's population, and that's how it's calculated?
And the emissions.
Right.
At the same time, the emissions, because, it's very correlated. On one side, also the growth rate, the population, and the contribution to the CO2 emissions.
Now, the silver lining of the pandemic that we've just been through, or that we're still going through, is that lockdown forced the world to suddenly cut down on carbon emissions in 2020. The recovery is now starting, and natural gas prices are soaring. Dateline Stockton-on-Tees, that's in northeast England, where the CF Industries fertilizer factory this week has been forced to suspend activity. Natural gas supplies are being siphoned off by Asian markets. It's already hitting industry, with farmers warning they won't be able to supply turkeys for Christmas in England without CO2 to preserve the birds.
It's a position where the price has spiked considerably. I've got a chart in front of me. I think it's quadrupled in the last 6 months, 7 months. You would expect normally that the price would revert to the mean. It's not something that we think is going to be sustainable. But of course, Mr. Jones, we have to prepare for longer term high prices.
So here we were last year hearing the birds and smelling the fresh air in Neri-Cheney. We're all fretting over the fact that our natural gas prices are about to go through the roof. What's going on?
But should we fret about that? Demand is much stronger than production, so pricings are going up. Is it such a bad thing that the market is sending a signal that we are just using too much natural gas, too much oil, or too much coal? If we don't have...
Well, we were told natural gas was this wonder product that was going to help us transition from fossil fuels. It's cleaner than coal or oil. So therefore, we can use that to transition towards the renewables that Dana was mentioning.
Well, look, natural gas is much better than coal or oil, but it's much worse than nuclear power or renewables in terms of carbon emissions. It is a fossil fuel which is producing CO2 for a transition period because it is hard to fund and to build new capabilities. And I insist on nuclear power, which is part of the equation, by the way. So it takes time. So natural gas is good when you are using coal. That's why Germany should stop using coal and doing something else, such as nuclear power. But my point is that the price signals are very important to help us to decarbonize our economies. So we don't like spikes, of course, especially when the winter is coming, because people need natural gas to heat themselves. So there might be some things to do to cut the spike. But my general view is that the very fact that the prices are going up is a good thing to force consumers and producers to go out of carbon-emitting sources and natural gas, which I prefer to call fossil gas, is one of these emitters.
A good thing if you're sitting on the left bank of Paris and you live in a comfortable apartment, but for working-class people, this is hard.
That's what I'm saying, that the spike in prices, you have to do something about that. And all the countries are trying to do something to smooth the spike. Okay, let's smooth the spike. Let's spend some money to smooth the spike. But there is no way to get out of the price increase to reduce carbon emissions. Whatever we do, whether it is regulation, whether it is carbon taxes, whether it is a carbon tax adjustment at the border, that will increase the price of energy linked to carbon.
All right, we're looking at the short term, and to stop those spikes, the Paris-based International Energy Agency has come out and urged Russia to supply more gas to the rest of Europe. Russia, whose flagship producer Gazprom recently announced completion of the Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline that runs through the Baltic Sea to Germany. It's not yet operational. But let me put it to you, Lori Milivirta, since in Helsinki, I don't know if you could see, you can't see Russia from your window, but still, we've been talking about the superpowers, U.S. and China. Suddenly, Russia becomes a lot more important these days.
I think what was just said about the spiking gas prices giving an incentive for everyone to start thinking about how to get rid of gas. I think that's really something that is going to get the ball rolling, and that will, in the longer term, also weaken the hold of natural gas or fossil gas, I agree, fossil gas suppliers on Europe. So in that sense, of course, it's not good that we're facing these high prices going into the winter, but it is showing that we have an unhealthy dependence on fossil gas. And before these price spikes, no one was talking about it.
An unhealthy dependence on fossil fuels and gases. And right now for Europe, it's an unhealthy dependence. Is it an unhealthy dependence on Russia? Was the United States right when it slammed Germany for doing that deal to build Nord Stream 2?
Simply from a climate perspective, building a huge pipeline to bring more fossil fuels into Europe, obviously that's wrong, and that's not the way investments should be going. That's not where infrastructure should be going. Leaving all the geopolitics aside. But of course, the fact that one country controls the other end of that pipeline is a huge vulnerability to Europe as well. So that's all the more reason to move from using gas to using electricity, to weatherizing homes, improving energy efficiency, electrifying industry, and so on, to get all of these sectors running on clean energy rather than fossil gas.
But of course, Anacreti, you can't put geopolitics aside, not in an era when we're seeing this renewal of antagonism between superpowers. And again, in the build-up to COP26, are we headed for a world where energy is going to be weaponized more?
This is something that has been always the case. And then depending on the historical contingencies, we think about a little bit more or less. So you are very brave to raise this question now. Of course, when there are negotiations, there is always another view on it, which is not only the megawatt hours. It's also who is the equilibrium, the pivotal agents in the world arena. Regarding Russia, what they do is that they have built this very important infrastructure in order to avoid to go through Ukraine, given that they don't have in a good mood. Yes.
Put it mildly.
Exactly. But at the same time, the infrastructure we are talking about, so Nord Stream 2, has been financed by a consortium, including also European gas producers or importers. So it's also, again, it's a matter of fact that Russia says, oh, you want my gas, let's see if I can send it to you through Nord Stream 2 or Nord Stream 1, knowing that there are potentially other supplies, but not as big as what Russia can do. On the other side, they also want to impose their force on oil prices. So they are playing through the, again, the pressure on the gas and on the oil in the OPEC Plus agreement in order to recall the world that they are, I mean, the richest country in fossil fuels, and at the moment, in the short term, there is a high reliance on their supply.
And they will be players in Glasgow, you're saying?
They will, together with the U.S.
All right. I want to thank you, Anacreti. I want to thank as well Eric Chanet, Rina Kui for being with us from Washington, and Lori Milivirta in Helsinki. Thank you for joining us here in the France 24 debate.